From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Our 87-year-old Holy Father has not showed signs of slowing down. This week, he opened the final Vatican assembly of the Synod on Synodality, and that comes just on the heels of two papal trips. Synodality and reaching out to the peripheries, both geographic and moral, are touchstones of Pope Francis's papacy. Today, EWTN News' Courtney Mares and Frank Rocha discuss these key parts of Pope Francis's legacy. Then we turn back to the U.S. elections with just a month to go before November 5th. We look at the vice presidential debate and the recent events that could impact the race to the White House with Peter Laughlin. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, and I'm your host here on Register Radio. I'm joined by two veteran Vatican reporters in Rome. Courtney Mares is a longtime reporter for Catholic News Agency, and Frank Rocha reported from Rome for many years for the Wall Street Journal and now is a Vatican analyst for EWTN News. Thank you, Courtney and Frank, for joining me on Register Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
The final stage of the global multi-year Synod on Synodality began with an opening mass on Wednesday, October 2nd, and an assembly of more than 400 people met at the Vatican in their first session that afternoon. So the 2024 meeting has about 368 voting members, those are called delegates, 272 of whom are bishops, and 96 of whom are not bishops, and among those 96 non-bishops, or about half are women. This is similar to last year. Courtney, this gathering goes on for a month or so. So, of course, we're in the wee days of proceedings. What should we know in these early days?
Well, as you said, we're still early on in the synod process, and I've covered enough synods to know to expect the unexpected in what might come up this month. One important thing to know going into the second assembly is that Pope Francis has made it clear that some of the more controversial subjects discussed at last year's assembly, including women deacons, are off the table for discussion in the assembly hall. Instead, these topics have been delegated to the work of study groups, and it will be interesting to watch these groups moving forward. There's also some concrete proposals that are up for discussion, including this idea of a new ministry of listening and accompaniment, as well as discussion on the role of bishops' conferences and greater lay involvement in parish finances and leadership. As to the day-to-day activities of the synod, it's very similar in format to what we saw at last year's synod assembly, with daily prayers, theological reflections, and many small group discussions, which are organized by language.
Right. Well, we have a great team there. So many of you are on the ground covering this, so there'll be a lot more news as the month goes on. It's a month long, so plenty of news on that. But Courtney, just to talk about the Pope's message as the Synod began, you covered his opening remarks. What did he have to say?
Yeah, already right off the bat, in the first meeting of the Synod Assembly on Wednesday, Pope Francis told the delegates that he wants to see more cooperation between bishops and lay people working together, and asked the synod to consider differing forms of a synodal exercise of a bishop's ministry. So that's a topic that we'll be sure to hear more about in the coming months. And okay. I was at the Pope's opening mass of the synod, where the Pope also had a warning for synod delegates against imposing their own agendas during the month-long discussions. And we heard Pope Francis stress the importance of listening to each other and prayer. He said especially prayer to the Holy Spirit can help bring harmony in a room full of many differing viewpoints and ideas.
Yes, well, we're going to get more to that point in a minute, this connection with synodality and listening. But Courtney, on that same day, October 2nd, the Pope also recognizing the events going on in the world, especially the Middle East, the wars and conflict there, the Pope called for a day of prayer and fasting on October 7th. What else did he have to say about that?
Yes, the Pope made a surprise announcement at the end of his homily for the Mass at the start of the Synod by calling for this global day of prayer and fasting for peace in the world. Now, this day of prayer is going to take place on October 7th, which, as we all know, is the one-year anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel and the start of the year-long war in Gaza that's followed. The Pope also revealed that he is planning to personally go to Rome's Basilica of St. Mary Major on the eve of the anniversary to pray the Rosary for peace amid this escalating violence in the Holy Land. And the Pope also invited Synod delegates to join him in praying this Rosary for peace.
It's very important. I think we'll all be joining in that Rosary for peace, especially as things escalate with Iran and in Lebanon. So I want to bring Frank into the conversation. Hello, Frank.
Hi.
It's so good to have you back. And you know, as I mentioned in the intro, synodality has been a common theme in the last few years of Francis's papacy, but the peripheries have also been a theme since the very beginning of his pontificate. So let's start with the concept of peripheries. Pope Francis has talked often about them, and he's gone all over the world. What does he mean by the peripheries?
Yeah, as you say, that this goes back to the very beginning, even before 2013, then Cardinal Bergoglio, when he gave a speech in the General Congregation to precede the conclave that elected him Pope, and he gave a speech that we know he said the Church was called to come out of herself and go to the peripheries, not only geographically, but also the existential peripheries, the mystery of sin, of pain, of injustice, of ignorance and indifference to religion, of intellectual currents, and of all misery. Well, that covers a lot of ground. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of his language, it's not very clearly defined. It's malleable. But I mean, we can see that, you know, in his trips, you know, he's tended to avoid, you know, certainly the Western European countries, and he likes to go to non-Catholic countries, countries where Catholics are a minority, even Christians are a minority, poor countries. So those are some of the senses in which he evidently needs peripheries.
Right, right. And Courtney, you just came back from a trip to some of those peripheries. It was geographic peripheries, but also young churches. What was characteristic? What has been, because you've been on a few of these trips, characteristic of Pope Francis's trips to those kind of peripheries? What did you see?
Yes, even in his old age, Pope Francis has been willing to travel far distances to visit these places that are considered missionary territory, where Catholics are either a small minority or so remote or impoverished that they would have little contact with the Pope or the Vatican otherwise. We saw this on the Pope's recent 12-day trip to Southeast Asia and Oceania, in which I was fortunate to be able to travel with the Pope on the papal plane to four what we would consider periphery countries. We visited Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world, where Catholics only make up 3% of the population. And yet, when more than 100,000 Catholics turned out for the Pope's Stadium Mass in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, and we just witnessed tons of enthusiasm and joy there with the local population. We then traveled to the peripheries of Papua New Guinea, where Pope Francis met with missionaries who traveled deep into the country's jungle rainforests to minister to the indigenous tribes who live there and have accepted the Catholic faith. Pope Francis also visited East Timor, which, as you mentioned, is a young country. It's a new island nation that was officially recognized as a country in 2002, and that is nearly 98% Catholic. East Timor is one of the least visited countries in the world, so definitely a periphery in that respect. And there's also widespread poverty there, and I met with some of the many religious orders who are present in East Timor and are active in serving the poor on the island. Finally, the trip concluded in the multicultural city-state of Singapore, an Asian financial hub, which is considered, you know, a gateway to China in some respects, certainly culturally, and is also a country that's smaller than New York City. So Pope Francis seems to have a soft spot for these other small countries.
Sure.
And while each of these Asian nations were extremely different from each other, the consistent thing that we really encountered in every stop along the way was joy and deep faith.
Right. And you wrote about that at the Register at ncregister.com. The title, Let the Islands Rejoice, which is a quote. And then you talk about it's my journey with Pope, with the Pope on to Oceania and Southeast Asia. So that's a piece at ncregister.com that Courtney Mares wrote after her trip, just reflecting on how that impacts one's faith, even as a journalist, to see the faith of these countries on the peripheries. Frank, we want to return to you because the idea for this segment contrasting the peripheries came from an article that you wrote for the Register. It was a preview to the Pope's trip to Belgium, and you identified that trip as another voyage to the peripheries. And I guess in that sense, it's the existential peripheries. So what were you identifying in that trip to Luxembourg and Belgium as peripheries, and why the Pope might go there with the same kind of mentality of reaching out?
Well, it's interesting, yeah. The where he went there is certainly part of the historic heartland of Catholicism in Europe. And in that sense, it's also peripheral to his concerns in general, as we said earlier. He hasn't tended to focus on that part of the world or that part of the church. But it's also now part of the peripheries of Catholicism. I mean, the percentage of people who identify as Catholic there has been plummeting. According to the Bishops' mm-hmm. Conference in Belgium in 2022, it was down to 50%, down 16% from 10 years earlier. So who knows what it is even now, a couple years later. And the mass attendance is under 10%, probably much lower than other counts. He was going into the heart of modern secular Europe. And we know that, of course, he had some friction there as a result. He said some things that were not well received that Courtney, I'm sure, followed.
Yes, he did, and we'll talk about that. But I thought it was also quite interesting. He, you know, one of the things you highlighted about Belgium is the problem of euthanasia there. It has had euthanasia for many, many years. It's really one of the places that has kind of led the push to legalize and allow euthanasia. And the Pope didn't actually mention that, but he had there when he was there, but he has mentioned that before. Can you give us some of that reporting? I mean, it was really great information, and with the United States faced with laws to legalize euthanasia or assisted suicide, I think it's important that we know of the problem of that in Belgium.
Belgium is on the vanguard of acceptance of euthanasia. It was the second country in the world after the neighboring Netherlands to legalize it in 2002, and it was the first Catholic country, first historically Catholic country, and it's just becoming more and more and more popular. Last year, I believe it was in the mid 3,500, something like that, and that was a rise of 15% over the previous year. So that's right. Euthanasia for minors, no minimum age limit. There's euthanasia for psychiatric patients. And even Catholic institutions are involved in this. And even some members of the Catholic hierarchy are sort of more, let's say, tolerant. Or they think that, well, maybe in some cases it's okay. The Pope has been pretty strong on it. But, yeah, he didn't talk about it there. This is something that we've seen in him. He often, when he goes to a place, people expect him to address the elephant in the room, so to speak, and he doesn't. And back in 10 years ago, he went to some African countries that passed anti-homosexuality laws, which some of them were very severe, and people thought, will he speak out against them? And he didn't. So this often happens that he won't address head on, but it was a notable omission, yes.
Right. That's very Latin American of him, though. I've seen that before. In Latin American countries, it's not always common to directly focus on things like that. So it's interesting. But, you know, both of you mentioned that he did talk about hot button issues there in Belgium. Courtney, he did not back down when he was confronted on the church's teaching on women. How did he respond to the complaints about the church not making women priests or allowing them to be in greater positions of authority?
The Pope essentially doubled down on his statements that there are important inherent differences between men and women, which the Pope described as written on our hearts. And this was after the Pope had come under fire from certain academics and students at one of the universities he visited in Belgium for a speech in which he described womanhood as life-giving, fruitful, and nurturing. And in his in-flight press conference, the Pope defended himself by saying he always speaks about the dignity of women. And if this sounds conservative to some people, it is because, and these are the Pope's words, they are obtuse and they do not want to hear this message. Wow. So we've heard the Pope give strong condemnations of gender ideology before, and this was an area on this trip where he was not afraid to be outspoken.
Right, right. Well, I thank you both for you know, giving your insights in this show and always to EWTN News and to the Register. I know there'll be a lot more to talk about as the Synod progresses, and we hope to have you both back soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeanette.
You've been listening to Register Radio on EWTN. When we come back, Peter Laughin will join us with U.S. election news and more. Stay tuned to Register Radio on EWTN.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. With a mere month left to Election Day on November 5th, I'm joined by Register staff writer Peter Laughin, who's been covering the race to the White House for the Register. It's certainly been a heated presidential campaign. And this week, Peter, we watched the vice presidential candidates in a debate. It was incumbent Republican Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, of course, on the Trump ticket, and incumbent Democrat Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, of course, for the Harris ticket. So do you think from their televised debate that the nation got a clearer picture of the candidates?
J.D. Vance certainly hopes so, because he performed fantastic on Tuesday night.
Yeah,
that was one of the most dominant performances you'll see in a debate. It's probably the most dominant performance by a Republican candidate since Mitt Romney's first debate against Barack Obama in 2012. From the very beginning of the night, Vance controlled in both style and substance. He guided the debate. He had incredibly crisp answers, and it was really remarkable the way he seemed to steer every question toward a rhetorical area that was favorable to the Republican ticket. And meanwhile, on the other side, Walz often looked very overwhelmed. You could tell that this was his first time on the national stage. You could also tell that he was maybe a little rusty, and I know a lot of Democratic media people and operatives today are thinking to themselves, man, we wish we would have given Walz a few more interviews so he could warm up for this.
So really a
dominating performance from front to back. Will it have an effect on the 2024 race? You know, who knows? Vice presidential debates rarely seem to. For my money, the debate on Tuesday night will have more effect on 2028, where I think it really solidified J.D. Vance's position as the head of the Republican Party in the post-Trump years.
Right, right. Yeah, and you wrote about this at ncregister.com. It was VP debate. Vance shines, Walz stumbles, and that was posted the day after the debates, just giving some analysis, some of these things you've mentioned. And you do talk a little bit about some of the policy issues. Ironically, they agreed on several points, right?
Yes. It was a surprisingly congenial and policy-heavy debate. That was one of the really strange aspects of it.
I would step in here, too. So very different from the presidential debate. I was watching going, oh my gosh, this is calm.
Yeah, almost downright friendly.
Right.
At times, you saw the two of them watching each other as the other spoke, respectfully nodding the head. And I know this made a lot of people mad on the left, because they're afraid that Walz's, you know, congenial manner. Walz said many times, well, I agree with a lot of what J.D. just said, that may have normalized the Republican agenda, normalized J.D. Vance, somebody they've spent the last 2 months hammering in the press
right,
as a MAGA radical. And I'll tell you, nobody watching that debate who's just tuning in, which is most of America, by the way. Most of America aren't politics geeks like some of us. Most of America is just tuning in. And they saw that debate, and they saw J.D. Vance, who, you know, they probably expected to see some foaming at the mouth radical. And instead they saw, wow, who's this very, you know, well put together, intelligent young man in charge of the facts? And, you know, he doesn't look like weird, like they told me. But, you know, in fact, maybe that Waltz guy looks a little weird.
Right. Right. There were some very stark differences, yes, in just their public persona before this and then after.
Right.
Yeah. So but one area that they did not agree on was abortion. This is an area of very stark differences between the two tickets, Trump Vance and Harris Walz. I mean, very stark. They couldn't be more night and day on abortion, especially regarding whether it should be an issue that's federally legislated. Obviously, the Harris Walz thinks that it should be and that it should be legalized. Trump and Vance say it's a state issue. So how did the two of them handle this particular issue on stage?
As you'd imagine, their answers were very different. But of all of the achievements of J.D. Vance's debate performance on Tuesday night, I'd say the abortion question was really where he outperformed his expectations. First, to the substance of the answers, Walz gave what you would expect. The answer from the Democratic Party in this day and age, in the post-Roe era, we want to have a federal codification of Roe versus Wade. He told many stories of women who, you know, were from abortion-restrictive states, had to drive. There's one woman he talked about had to drive 600 miles out of her state to get an abortion in another state. And Vance seemed to almost take an apologetic stance on this. He almost seemed to say, well, we're very sorry this is happening. And he mentioned a few times that the Republican Party needs to win back the trust of voters on the issue of abortion. And to pass really truly pro-family, pro-fertility treatment, he said, policies. And acknowledging that, yeah, Republicans have not won the state ballot amendment issues, including in his own state of Ohio. But then he did something that I thought was incredible. It's something that the pro-life movement has wanted to see on national TV for decades, and no politician has been nimble enough to sort of provide it. And what he did was he got Tim Walz to have to defend his very, very pro-radical abortion stance in Minnesota. Now, the National Catholic Register has been all over this story. Our own Matthew McDonald has had a few big viral moments with the story he did on the 2015 abortion law in Minnesota that Tim Walz signed into law, which states that doctors do not have to offer life-saving treatments to babies who are born alive after botched abortions. Vance was able to bring this up in the middle of the debate, and Walz had to defend that. Now, of course, he lied and said that that's not the law, that he was misreading it. And Vance said, well, tell me how I got that wrong. And Walz wasn't able to answer that.
Right.
And so that was just an incredible, incredible achievement for the pro-life community. Even if many in the pro-life activists wouldn't like Vance's answer on states' rights, we want to vote this out. Seeing a Democrat have to defend abortion radical positions was really something to behold.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think that, you know, to Walz, what Walz and the Democrats are trying to do here is they say, well, the law is we offer, you know, care to those babies. But that is what is really happening is that they're not offering life-saving care, which was the law that he changed. And you're right, NC Register has been covering this. It's been very important. We are down to a minute left. One place we will not see both candidates on stage soon is at the Al Smith dinner. And I do want to point to an editorial that the Register did about this Al Smith dinner, because this is a Catholic event where typically both candidates from the parties are on stage and have an opportunity to address the Catholics in the room. It's usually quite humorous. They roast each other, and it's a lot of fun. But Kamala Harris did not accept the invitation. And so I suggest to our listeners to go to ncregister.com and look at this very interesting editorial about the Al Smith dinner and Kamala's rejection of that opportunity. So, Peter, I'm always glad to be with you on Register Radio, to be able to talk about what's happening in our country, and I'm sure in the next month we'll have more conversation. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much, Jeanette.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, to check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, and myself, Jeanette DeMello, I pray that God blesses you.